question, call 718-512-5008. That's 718-512-5008. Disgrace the races. We under. I
wonder what it takes to make this one better place. Let's erase the waste. Hi, I'm Rosie Perez, and this is WBAI, listener-supported non-commercial radio in New York.
Welcome, friends, to Economic Update. This is Richard Wolff, and I want to welcome you to our weekly program by beginning, as we always do, to thank John Lee Hooker and Carlos Santana for reminding us so beautifully that the one thing that never changes is the process of change itself. My name is Richard Wolff. We come to you from station WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. I've been a professor of economics all my life at several universities. Currently, I earn my income teaching as a visiting professor in the Graduate Program for International Affairs of the New School University in New York City. And I also write columns of economic analysis for the website truthout.org. Truthout is a courageous source of independent news, news analysis, and commentary every day. Please keep sending in your questions and comments. I remind you of this each week because we reach every single one, and we not only select the few that we have the time to respond to on the air, but we also use them, as you're going to see today, to craft, to organize, to arrange the programs and the substance of what we do on the regular part of our programming as well. So they're very important feedback for us. Send them, as always, to rdwolff.com, rdwolff.com, and that's where we get them and read them and respond as we can on the air. Today I'm going to ask your indulgence to make an experiment of a sort. We're going to depart from our usual way of organizing these programs, which have to do with an opening set of short economic updates, and then either an interview or a more extended discussion of important topics, and then a concluding segment where we respond to your questions and comments. That's our normal schedule. Today we're going to try something else. It's a new year. It's a chance to take a step back from the ebb and flow of economic events, and at the same time, to try to gather a whole group of the questions and comments many of you sent in during 2012, and to somehow take a long view, an overview, if you like, of economics as a whole, rather than focusing it so specifically. And this also gives me a chance to provide you with a kind of overview of the field of economics that we're using and applying, you might say, on a weekly basis in this program. As it happens, over the last year, in fact, to be precise, late in August of 2012, I published a book together with my frequent co-author, Stephen Resnick, and together we published a book called Contending Economic Theories, Neoclassical, Keynesian, and Marxian. The publisher we chose for this book is the MIT Press, Massachusetts Institute of Technology Press. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to talk about economic theory, the basic way that human beings these days in the world have for making sense of what's going on in the economy. And by making sense, I mean trying to understand why we're in a crisis now. What does that mean? Why do things like inflations and recessions and unemployment, why do they happen? What causes these events? How do I understand my own experience? The job I can get or lose? The income I hope to get, do actually get, have to make do with? Whether the media representations, the stories on TV that I see, are they reliable? Are they true? Are they accurate? How do we handle, as human beings, understanding the economic dimensions of our lives? How goods get produced, how they get distributed, why some people are rich and poor, all those kinds of questions. Every day in the United States and around the world, people from all different points of view and all different parts of life are continuously having to assess economics. They have to decide what jobs to pursue, what educations to choose, what investments to make, whether to save money, and if so, how. 1,000 decisions of life, as well as making sense of economics, is something imposed on us by the sheer process of life itself. So the question is, how do we acquire the ways we think about economics? Because, as you will see, people do it very differently. Just as there are very different ways of dressing, or singing, or eating, or dreaming, there are also different ways of making sense of economic systems and of economic events around us. It's even more complicated than that. It turns out that in economics, as in so many fields of human knowledge, there are always multiple different points of view. Economics is not some straightforward activity. It's not like fixing the carburetor on your car where you learn, well, here's the air and here's the gas and here's how they have to mix and then you need a spark and so forth. None of that. It's not a straightforward, here's how it works kind of discipline. Economics, from the beginning, has always been a contested topic. That's why we call the book different or contending economic theories, because there's always been difference of opinion about how economies work, why things like inflations or depressions happen, why some people are rich and poor. There have always been multiple different answers to these questions, multiple different theories that people have, ways of understanding what's going on in the economy. But I'm going to try to make it clear and understandable, because that's what a teacher should try to do in all areas. And so that's the task I set myself. So here's how we're going to do it. We're going to begin by noting that there are today really two major schools or two major theories of economics. Two major ways of understanding how the economies in our countries and across the world, how they mostly work, why they work the way they do, why they yield the results they do, why they have the problems they do. There are two. One is an approach that looks at the economic systems we have, or rather the system we have, since we are mostly of one kind around the world these days. And that system has a name, capitalism. These are approaches, if you like, that look upon capitalism with a very favorable eye. What unites all of these folks, and you're going to learn about some of their differences, but what unites them all is that they think capitalism is wonderful. And that if you give it half a chance, it can and it will do wonders for people. It is the best available economic system. It yields the best available economic results. And so we should celebrate it. We should help it in the ways I'm going to work out over the next minutes as we talk. So let's get into it. In order to understand a theory, you quickly discover that among the many, 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 many people who contribute to developing every theory of anything, there are a few individuals who stand out. They are the people who were born at the right time, that all the influences of an economic reality somehow came to play on their little brains as kids, as they grew up, as they lived in the world, as they had the feeling, the desire, the talent to write, that they could write down how they understood the economic aspects of life, the production and distribution of goods and services, and all that that means. Somehow these individuals did it so well that they came to be looked upon as the founders of the theory, the greatest exponents of the theory. I like best the phrase of the famous Italian thinker Antonio Gramsci, who referred to these people as organic individuals, the sort of outstanding people whose own expressions in speeches, in articles, in books, whatever form it took, captured something that everybody else could kind of recognize in the years later as a real insight into how the economy works. In the field of economics, those who celebrate the capitalist system, our economic system, who are the organic intellectuals, who are the leading lights, if you like, of understanding it, are three. And I'm going to give you their names because they are the three giants of the field in terms of all of those who fundamentally celebrate and applaud capitalism. Some names have been well known, some less known, but these three stand out. First, Adam Smith, whose famous work, The Wealth of Nations, was produced in the same year as the American Revolution, so in the late 18th century. The second came right after Adam Smith, also in England, David Ricardo, a British banker, but a prolific writer whose work, like Smith's, set the tone, provided the framework for what is modern economics, at least in the way that the mainstream of thinkers make sense, the way they make sense of economics. And the third of the three great thinkers of modern capitalist celebrating economics is another British person. Notice they're all British. John Maynard Keynes, spelled K-E-Y-N-E-S, who comes much later. He comes in the middle of the 20th century, or the first half of the 20th century, so much later than Smith and Ricardo. But he, too, like them, is someone who thinks capitalism is fundamentally the best the human race has achieved and is likely to be able to achieve, and who celebrates it, but in a way that's different from Smith and Ricardo, as I will make clear. So let's stay with this approach to economics, and let's ask, what is it all about? To understand this, you have to understand when economics emerges, when Smith and Ricardo write. I've already mentioned it's at the end of the 18th and the early part of the 19th century that Smith and Ricardo do their work. What is happening at that time that might help us understand why they are so important? Here's the answer. This is a time, the 17th and 18th century, of the end of an economic system that had dominated across Europe for over 1,000 years. It has a name, feudalism. It was a way of organizing economics very different from the capitalist system we have today. So, for example, for much of that feudalism, there were no such things as the capitalist reality we take for granted today. For example, most people did not go to work for a wage. There was no such thing as wages for most of the people in most of feudalism for over 1,000 years. Where you worked was not dependent on a deal you made with some employer. Where you worked was dependent on where you were born and who your parents were. If your parents were peasants, serfs they were called in those days, they were attached to a piece of land, and if you were their child, you were similarly attached. And when they passed on, you did the work they had done on the same piece of land. And the way feudalism worked out was roughly as follows. And here's a typical example of something you could find everywhere, from Sweden in the north, to Italy in the south, to Ireland in the west, to Poland in the east, and none of those things existed as such in those days, because those countries weren't formed yet at that time. But in the feudal system, you typically did the following. For 3 days a week, you worked on the land that you had been born to. And you kept the produce that you grew. You kept the eggs that your chickens produced on those 3 days. But the other 3 days of the week, you worked on the land of somebody else. That person was known as a feudal lord. He was a person, because it wasn't allowed to women most of the time, he was a person who presided over a big stretch of land on which lots of little serf families lived. Half of every week, first 3 days, the serf families worked on their own land, and they kept the fruits of their own labor. The other 3 days, they worked on the land of the lord, and whatever they produced there by this 3 days of labor they did there was the lord's. And on the seventh day, they rested, maybe going to church, maybe relaxing, and then next week they did it all again. 3 days, they produced output that they could keep for themselves and their families. The other 3 days, they produced output, a surplus over and above what they produced and kept, that belonged to somebody else, the Lord. The Lord didn't pay them a wage that never arose. Goods and services were not traded very much. Markets didn't play much of a role. Very different economic system from what we are used to. But that system began to crumble. Oh, around 10th century, 11th century, feudalism began to suffer all kinds of internal problems, and the feudal lords began to find their serfs bitter about having to produce so much for folks other than themselves, resentful of the lords who kept squeezing more and more out of them. Trouble began, revolts began, all kinds of tension. And feudalism began to break down, and the feudal lords were very frightened that their system was fading, and so they decided to develop strong central state authorities. We call them absolute monarchies. You've seen them in the movies, those famous things like Louis XIV or Louis XVI, who built those splendid chateaus and castles, the one near Paris called Versailles being perhaps the world's most spectacular example. Powerful central states that could organize and amass huge armies to try to protect feudalism from its own internal collapse. But it didn't work. At best, it postponed the breakdown of that system. And so feudalism by the 17th or 18th century was breaking down, much as other systems before feudalism, who also existed sometimes for thousands of years, also had broken down. In fact, one of the things we know about human history is that every economic system that we've had as a race, I'm talking about the human race, have had their birth, have had their evolution, and have had their death. Feudalism died in the 16th, 17th, and 18th century. And as it broke down, the links that bound serfs to the land, that bound serfs and lords in this feudal system, collapsed, broke apart, couldn't be sustained even with powerful, autocratic, absolutist governments. And what happened? a new system was born in the breakdown of the old. In the collapse of the old, something new was born. And that, too, is a constant pattern in economic history. What was born in the 17th and 18th century was a new way of organizing the production and distribution of goods and services that we all depend on to survive, let alone to grow. Instead of you being assigned to the land of the people who were your parents, you became, to use the language of the time, free. You weren't tied to the land. You weren't tied to some lord because he presided over the land on which your parents lived. No, instead, you were free to work for anybody you chose to work for. You were free to work for yourself if you could manage it. Economic activity became much more self-directed and much less shaped by the particularities of the feudal system. And the deal made between person A and person B, so that one of them was the quote-unquote employer of the other, something altogether new that had never existed in feudalism, that deal was called a labor contract. It could be verbal, it could be written down, but that's what it was. It was an agreement by one person to work for another person and to be paid a regular sum of money per hour, per week, to do so. And you did this 5 out of the 7 days of the week, or even more. It was none of that 3 days on, 3 days off split that we talked about in feudalism. And Smith and Ricardo were these great thinkers who lived just at that time, with the collapse of feudalism well underway and the birth of this new system, the system in which some people were in a position to hire other people, or to say the same thing from the other point of view, some people, in order to survive, needed to find someone to pay them something, otherwise they wouldn't. So some people survived by being an employee, and others by being an employer. And the name that came to be attached to the employer was capitalist. And the money that that person used to hire somebody else was considered part of the employer's capital. Smith and Ricardo thought that capitalism was a wonderful system. They believed it would be much more productive of goods and services than feudalism had been able to be. They particularly liked capitalism because they saw it as an antidote to the powerful absolute states that had tried to hold feudalism together. So excited were Smith and Ricardo that they saw capitalism not only as an antidote, as an alternative to feudalism and to the absolute states that tried unsuccessfully to hold feudalism together, but they got really excited and enthusiastic and began to believe and to say, and their followers said it even more, that capitalism would usher in a new world, a world in which not only would you not need the powerful autocratic absolute states of Europe at the end of feudalism, but precisely the opposite, that capitalism didn't want a powerful state, didn't need a powerful state. That capitalism was a system in which men and women entered voluntarily into contracts that were mutually beneficial. Those who needed work found it. Those who needed workers found them. And in the deal they struck, the wage-labor contract, both sides would be receiving what they needed and wanted. And there wouldn't be the need for a powerful central government. People would be free of that. They saw freedom as overwhelmingly freedom from the interference of a state. And they, in the words of the French, who made a big revolution about this in the 18th century, they began to say that capitalism is a new economic system that will usher in liberty, equality, and fraternity, brotherhood. It will make us all collaborators voluntarily in a system of production that we all depend upon and that we will all participate in producing. So capitalism was to usher in human freedom, a freedom without the state as this overwhelming presence enforcing an old and unfair economic system. It would mean liberty and equality. You can find this in the French Revolution, in the American Revolution, in the earlier English Revolution, and ever since around the world. Capitalism and freedom, capitalism and efficiency, capitalism and productivity. And what would be the hallmarks of this new system? Two things. Private property, and markets. What do they mean? The argument was, in the old days, land was controlled hereditarily by families, by the power of the church that enforced the law of the family, by the kings who made sure that the old feudal system, that a few people had the land and presided over it, and the mass of people were the serfs who worked for the few. All of that would be gotten rid of. Instead, you would get as much property as you worked hard to acquire. And what you worked to acquire would be yours, not belong to anybody by hereditary meaning, by a powerful state, none of that. You would be guaranteed in this new system to work, to acquire, to accumulate, and to own. And the only way anyone could get at anything you had acquired and owned was by making a bargain with you. That's what the market is about. They would have to come and pay you to buy what you have or to rent what you have. But whatever happened to what you own, you never had to part with it unless you were willing to, unless you made a market exchange, giving up what you own to get something else that you wanted even more. Everybody free to own private property, and everybody negotiating with everybody else through a market, through voluntary exchanges. This was the hallmark of capitalism. This was a better and more efficient system. This would lead people to work hard to acquire the property. This would make us all interact with one another in mutually beneficial ways, because in a market you only have a transaction if both sides of it are agreeable. Smith and Ricardo waxed poetic about this system. They saw it as a vast improvement over feudalism, and they undertook to analyze how it worked from the standpoint of admirers, of celebrators. But they were thinkers of real quality, so their admiration, their love of capitalism wasn't blind. They did not need to do what, unfortunately, so many of their students have felt the need to do. That is, they were not blind to capitalism's problems, capitalism's flaws, capitalism's weaknesses. They loved capitalism despite them, but they didn't feel the need to magically imagine that they weren't there. And what were the big flaws of capitalism that Smith and Ricardo recognized? Well, there were many small ones, and their voluminous works are full of references and analysis of them. But there were two that I want to stress. The first was that capitalism had a troubling tendency to produce inequality. It accumulated wealth in the hands of relatively few, and reproduced poverty and economic difficulty for the mass of people. It didn't do that in a straight line. It didn't always go in one direction. periodically, the mass of people, if deprived too much, fought back and could change things, could redistribute wealth one way or another back into their own hands, at least to some degree. But sooner or later, the underlying trend of capitalism was, as it has been in recent decades, towards more and more inequality. The Occupy Wall Street movement coined the phrase the 1% versus the 99%. But in doing that, they simply recognized, identified, and pointed a powerful finger at an underlying tendency of capitalism that has been noted by many economists for a long time. And the second basic problem or flaw or weakness of capitalism that was also noted by Smith and Ricardo, as by others, has been its fundamental and startling instability. Capitalism is profoundly unstable. Every 3 to 7 years, it has an economic downturn. That is, people are thrown out of work. Businesses stop functioning. Output gets scaled back, not because there's a problem in the materials that are being used, not at all. Not that there's a problem in the technology that people have, not at all. Not that there's a problem in the weather or in nature not cooperating, not at all. No, all of those are fine. But nonetheless, the economy stumbles and falls. Sometimes it's only for a few months. Sometimes, as in the current situation, it's for many years. And that has to do with the relationships of people and businesses inside capitalism. It stumbles of its own accord by virtue of its own mechanisms, and it does so often. In the 1930s, one of these economic downturns was so bad and lasted so long, roughly from 1929 to 1940, 11 years, that the third great figure among those who like capitalism arose, another organic intellectual, somebody who lived at the right moment to capture something everyone has learned from since. In the depths of that depression, when capitalism's flaws, the inequality of rich and poor, and worst still, the instability that was so devastating, produced John Maynard Keynes. He really liked capitalism, but in a different way from Smith and Ricardo. And after we take our musical break, as we always do in the middle of the program, I will come back and tell you what Keynes's contribution was, and then we'll turn to the critic of capitalism, Karl Marx.
You are enjoying the miracle of radio.
Meanwhile, behind the facade of this innocent-looking bookstore...
Hear that tune? It's that damn thing I couldn't get out of my head. Now I know what I had you before, of course.
Ladies and gentlemen, with your kind attention and permission, I have now the honor to present to you one of the most remarkable men in the world.
Peter Beauchamp.
The future of rock and roll.
Who is this person?
The future of rock and roll.
And in left media.
Let me play something bright and snappy on that box.
Okay, be ready. Come soon. You ready?
Mm-hmm. All Mixed Up with Peter Beauchamp. Monday mornings at 10 a.m. here on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York.
That's what I live for.
WBAI is having a book sale with books and DVDs and CDs, some old stuff, some new stuff, including overstock items, premium remainders, and some of the most cherished items right off our bookshelves. Don't miss it. Starting Monday, January 14th through Wednesday, January 23rd, on weekdays from 12 noon till 7 p.m. and on the weekend from 10 a.m. till 3 p.m. Call 212-209-2800 to RSVP Entree into the building. That's 120 Wall Street, 10th floor. That's Monday, January 14th through Wednesday, January 23rd. The WBAI End of an Era Book Fair.
Welcome back to this discussion of economic theories. We've been discussing the development of the mainstream theory, sometimes, by the way, called neoclassical economics, that celebrates capitalism. And we closed by noting that not only did Smith and Ricardo, the great beginners of modern economic theory, the dominant school, not only did they recognize that capitalism has flaws, but in the Great Depression of the 1930s, the third great thinker, John Maynard Keynes in England, who lived and thought in the depths of this worst breakdown of capitalist instability, he came up with a variation. He said roughly the following: capitalism is a wonderful engine of progress and of productivity, but left to its own devices, by virtue of its own internal mechanisms, it regularly breaks down, and that these breakdowns are colossal wastes of human beings and of resources, and they threaten capitalism, which he, Keynes, thought was a great system, because they will turn off so many people that the people themselves may get rid of capitalism because it's too difficult, and that for those reasons, something has to be done to either moderate capitalism's instability, what the friends of capitalism preferred to call its business cycles. So that something had to be done to either moderate those or to prevent them altogether. And so John Maynard Keynes devoted much of his adult body of work to coming up with an analysis. And roughly, here's what it was. We have to have the government intervene. The government has to make sure that those situations having to do with the supply of money and the demand for money in an economy, having to do with the investment decisions businesses make, having to do with the decision all income recipients make between whether they spend their money or save it, those kinds of decisions can produce altogether breakdown. And the government can and should intervene to either make them short and shallow or to prevent them altogether. And he worked out what we nowadays call monetary and fiscal policies to do that. And he was fairly confident that they would work, and huge numbers of economists have developed his approach to try to make them work better. So there we are. Adam Smith, David Ricardo, John Maynard Keynes, people who loved capitalism. Smith and Ricardo tended to think that the government could be well kept away, but then Keynes came along and said, well, not so much. We have to have the government in there, otherwise the instabilities and also the inequalities of capitalism could undermine it, could withdraw mass public support. So let's sum up. This approach of people who like capitalism divides a little bit among those who want less government and those who want more, but they share an appreciation of capitalism. The job of the government among Keynesians is simply to make it work smoothly, to limit the disruption and the inequality that in the end threaten it. And like all systems of thought, there are also tensions between those who are theoretical, who think that the system really works well and don't care that much about the practical sides of it, and then those that are more practically interested. Here in the United States, and indeed in many parts of the world, you can see that, because economics is a very peculiar discipline. In every university, practically everyone, there is an economics department. And in most of those universities, say here in the United States, there is also another department, not called the economics department, where much the same material is gone over. It's called a business school. The people in the business school typically have very little use for those in the economics department and vice versa. They don't quite like each other most of the time. They don't get along real well, and they don't cooperate very much. That's certainly been my experience in all the universities where I've been a member of economics departments. We in the economics department think we understand the economy as a whole. Those in the business school don't think we do. We think they're just doing the details of how to run a business. They think they have their pulse on what's really going on. It's an interesting split between those who do the theoretical justification and celebration of the system, that's in the economics department, and those who deal with the nitty-gritty of how a business really works, what has to be done, what's the marketing, what's the accounting, what's the real business. And those are in a completely different school. It's a tension between those who do the theoretical rationale and those who do the practical work. So that's the major school of economics. That's the one that most people learn. That's the one that is mostly used by our politicians. It's the one that is mostly used by the people who design and control the media in our society. It's the way most of Americans and most of people in the rest of the world make sense of what's happening in the economy. Even if they're not aware that they're using that theory, even if they've never taken a course or read a book about it, they have absorbed this way of thinking because it is so dominant in the world. However, and here I'm dealing with many of your questions, it is not the only way to make sense of the world. It never was. It is not the only approach. It never was. There are others, with an S at the end, several others. But one in particular has, for a long time, been the number one, the most widely used, the most widely studied alternative. And it's interesting because of what it has to say, but of course, and perhaps mostly, because it is a fundamentally different take on how the economy works. Its author, the great organic intellectual, the equivalent among critics of capitalism to what Smith, Ricardo, and Keynes have been among celebrants of capitalism, was Karl Marx, originally born in Germany, but who spent most of his adult life and his creative time in Great Britain, an exile from his native Germany, but someone who, like Smith and Ricardo and Keynes, was a British resident and a British thinker in the sense of where he did his work. He didn't like capitalism. He had a different approach. In his view, and he was a great student of Smith and Ricardo's, by the way, wrote extensively about them. In his view, they had made a fundamental mistake, much as he learned a great deal from them. And their mistake, in his view, was the following. They thought capitalism was fundamentally different from the feudalism it displaced. Marx disagreed. They thought capitalism would bring freedom, equality, and brotherhood by its basic institutions of private property and markets. Marx thought they were wrong. Wow. How did Marx come to these ideas, and how did he make his points? And as I explain them, please note the applicability of his thinking to our time and place, just as I want you to note the applicability of Smith, Ricardo, and Keynes to our times and our places. In many ways, the disputes amongst economists today are expressions, extensions of the basic alternatives represented by Smith, Ricardo, and Keynes on one side and Marx on the other. Here is Marx's basic argument. In feudalism, to remind you from what we said in the first half of the program, workers had 3 days a week that they worked, in a sense, for themselves on the land where they could keep the output. And the other 3 days of the week, of the work week, they worked for the Lord on land where the produce of their labor, the crops, the animals, the crafts they produced, belonged instantly and automatically to somebody else, the Lord. Marx said, with the arrival of capitalism, that basic situation had not been overcome. It was disguised, he said, but it wasn't so different in capitalism. And here's how he made that argument. And I'm going to update it just to make it as understandable as I know how. He said the following. When you sit down with an employer to discuss the job you would like to get from the employer, here's the bottom line. When you and the employer agree, let's say, to get $20 an hour for your work, here's what's going on, Marx teaches. You will work for an hour, and the employer will pay you $20 for each hour. And the employer will do that if and only if the following statement is true. During that hour that you work, you are going to produce goods and services which become immediately the property of your employer, who intends to sell them as the output of the enterprise in which you are working. And the value of the extra output your labor helps him to produce has to be worth more than $20. The output that you produce, that you help to produce for your employer in the hour that you work, has to be worth more than $20. Otherwise, the employer would not hire you. The employer is not going to pay you $20 for work you do that provides him with an extra $20 worth of whatever the company makes that he sells, because then there's nothing in it for him. The profit that a capitalist employer gets is then, Marx argues, precisely the difference between what the workers produce and what the employer pays them. Workers always, in Marx's language, produce a surplus. That's the condition of having the job in the first place. You produce more than you get in capitalism. And that's Marx's aha moment. His aha comes when he points out that's like feudalism. In feudalism, you work part of the time from what you get, the 3 days of the week you work where you keep the produce. But the other 3 days, you work and someone else gets it. So it is in capitalism, he says. Part of the day you're working to produce an output, the employer sells and gives you the money as your wage. But you have to work more than that. You have to work extra, more hours. Or, if you like, part of every hour is work producing value above what you get. The extra you produce over and above what the employer pays you, that's his. That's his. And that's no different from feudalism, says Marx. The form has changed. You're an employee. He's an employer. You didn't have that in feudalism. He's an individual with freedom. You didn't have that in serfdom, in feudalism. So, yes, the systems are different, but not in the fundamental way that for Marx made all the difference. So capitalism changed the situation between the mass of people and a small minority. It changed it in many ways, but it did not change one thing, that the mass of people in capitalism continue to produce a surplus that a small minority gather into their hands and use to keep a system going that has them at the top. So Marx concluded that capitalism will always be a highly contested, tension-ridden, conflict-laden economic system, because the interests of the workers and the capitalists, like that splitting the serfs from the lords, is a fundamental conflict of interest. That capitalism will see the capitalists figuring out ways to take more and more of the surplus into their own hands, to become ever richer, to squeeze ever more out of the workers, to get them to accept lower pay so that more of what they produce is the surplus gathered into the hands of their employers. That competition among employers will reduce their number so that an ever larger businesses produce ever larger wealth for smaller numbers of people. That's what happened in feudalism. That's what also happens in capitalism, Marx argues. In a sense, Marx's argument is capitalism, like its predecessor, is showing the signs of an internally conflicted system that will have more and more troubles. And here comes the irony, Marx says. As the system experiences troubles, conflicts, conflicts rooted for Marx in this business in which the mass of people produce a surplus for a minority of people who use that surplus to keep themselves in this dominant position. The tensions will produce inequality. The tensions will produce business cycles. These difficulties of capitalism will lead capitalists to rely more and more on powerful state apparatuses, just as the feudal lords did. And eventually the mass of people will see the feudal lords and the absolute state as blending into one another as the enemy. That's what happened in feudalism, and Marx argued that's what's going to happen. Or nowadays, Marxists would probably argue that has already happened in capitalism. So where does that leave us with these two contending theoretical frameworks, Smith, Ricardo, and Keynes, celebrants of capitalism, Marx a critic? Well, I think the answer is fairly obvious. Both of these approaches have insights to deliver to us. Both of these approaches shed light. Both of these approaches help us to understand a complex economic system. We shouldn't focus only on one, as is unfortunately the case most of the time. We should teach and use both of them, and let the users and the reality they're trying to understand shape how we combine those insights. Let me give you a metaphor to drive home what I mean. If you wanted to understand a family down the street that had two kids, one of whom thought they lived in the best family the world had ever seen, and the other one thought, no, it was a troubled and destructive family, and you wanted to understand the family dynamics, would you talk to only one, either one, or would you think it's appropriate and necessary to get the insights from both the celebrant and the critic in order to frame your own understanding based on the insights derived from both of their analyses? I think the answer is obvious. We need to undo the imbalance of teaching the celebration of capitalism to the exclusion of the criticism, especially now in a world where capitalism is delivering extreme inequality and extreme instability. It's long past due to give the critical perspective its exposure for the benefit of us all. Thank you again for your time. Let me know what you think about this departure from our normal practice. I look forward to speaking with you again next week.
shame. Shame, baby. Your time now, baby. But after a while, it's gonna be my time, baby. Thing gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change, change. Thing gonna change. Yes, it is.
On Sunday, January 13th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl will feature Miss Jane Cortez, writer, poet, performance artist, and co-founder of Yari Yari, an international conference on literature by women of African descent. That's Sunday, January 13th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the recording session.
WBAI is having a book sale with books and DVDs and CDs, some old stuff, some new stuff, including overstock items, premium remainders, and some of the most cherished items right off our bookshelves. Don't miss it. Starting Monday, January 14th through Wednesday, January 23rd, on weekdays from 12 noon till 7 p.m., and on the weekend from 10 a.m. till 3 p.m. Call 212-209-2800 to RSVP Entree into the building. That's 120 Wall Street, 10th floor. That's Monday, January 14th through Wednesday, January 23rd. The WBAI End of an Era Book Fair.
Hey, it's Earth Mom, and I really want to thank these wonderful restaurants that donated to our October and December fund drives. The 99% Vegetarian Food Truck opposite Zuccotti Park. Arthur's Coffee Place on Wall between Water and Pearl Streets. Beckett's on Pearl Street. Brasserie Les Halles. Caruso's Pizza on Fulton Street. Cinnamon Snail Vegan Food Truck. Falafel Express on Madison at 97th. Joseph's Restaurante at 3 Hanover Square, Juju Cafe on Maiden Lane, Numero 28 Pizzeria on 2nd Avenue at 11th Street, Red at the South Street Seaport, Suen Macrobiotic on East 6th, United Taste of Africa, and the iconic Wohops at 17 Mott Street. Please patronize these restaurants and give them a great big thank you when you're there.
You are enjoying the miracle of radio.
Meanwhile, behind the facade of this innocent-looking bookstore...
Hear that tune? It's that damn thing I couldn't get out of my head. Now I know what I had it before, of course.
Ladies and gentlemen, with your kind attention and permission, I have now the honor to present to you one of the most remarkable men in the world.
Peter Beauchamp.
The future of rock and roll.
Who is this person?
The future of rock and roll.
And it left the media.
He plays a bright and snappy on that box.
Okay, be ready. It's going to come soon. You ready?
Mm-hmm. All Mixed Up with Peter Beauchamp. Monday mornings at 10 a.m. Here on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York.
That's what I live for.
My years of struggle, both north and south, I have come to appreciate the role which the radio announcer plays in the life of our people. For better or for worse, you are opinion makers in the community. The masses of Americans who have been denied and deprived educational and economic opportunity are almost totally dependent on radio as their means of relating to the society at large.
Tune in to the WBAI Radio Tribute to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Monday, January 21st, 6 a.m. till midnight, over WBAI 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
Hi, this is Julian Joiello, and I'm a listener and supporter of WBAI. I'm 20 years old, and I'm a student at NYU, and I live in New York City. And I want to shout out to the other young listeners of WBAI. We have to help keep the station going, and the easiest way to do it is through the WBAI Buddy System. If you donate as little as $10 a month, you have proactively promoted free speech radio. Go to the website, WBAI.org, click the donate button,